Hello, welcome back to the podcast. I'm so grateful that you're here. I know it's been a little bit of a while. It's been almost 2 months since the last podcast, but we've been busy. We've been doing things, living out in the world, getting new ideas and information to bring back to you. And this week's episode, it's been a while, so we're going to make it extra tasty and informative to you. What we have on the deck is, first, we did a little ski trip to Colorado, checked out some real estate there, skied the slopes, and we have some a little insight about how you can maybe get your last spring break trip in before the season's over. It's getting late in March, but they've had a very busy snow season, lots of snow, deep pack. It was a great time, and this time of year, it's just sunshine nonstop, so you're going to want to hear a little bit about that, a little bit about Beaver Creek, Colorado. Then we're going to follow up with some Manhattan and Brooklyn snapshots for the month of February 2017. 2017, that's time is ticking by. And speaking of time ticking by, it was my birthday last week. Woo! Happy birthday to me. We have a couple more birthdays in March. We'll have some shout-outs there. And lastly, we're going to follow up with our interview with Trevor Mengel. He's a ad tech digital professional. It's a little bit dated from the fall, but it's a lot of pertinent information considering your privacy, data collection, how the industry works. And we talk a little bit about his life and traveling in Japan and everything in between. So it's going to be a good episode. Thank you for tuning in. And without further ado, here's the show. Oh, and we're back. Today, we're talking about Beaver Creek, Colorado. We recently had a little trip there in February, and man, did I have a good time. It's a pretty easy jump from New York City. I mean, you can get a direct flight from any three of the airports in about four and a half hours, and if you plan your trip out, you can get some pretty decent prices because Denver Airport is very easy to fly out of. They've got a lot of flights going in and out of there, and it's got a very nice architectural design. It was, if you've ever been there, it's like a white tent over the airport, and that's kind of to show, you know, let it blend into the mountains if you wish. Denver's kind of on the foothills of the Rockies. You actually need to go 40 minutes, half hour to get up into the hills. But Beaver Creek, which we're going to focus on right now, is about a 2 hour drive from the airport. And we took the Colorado Mountain Express. It's a little bus that takes you out there in a group van. And it's nice. It's a nice little time, and chatted it up with my driver and the nice little family from the Midwest who was coming out to go check out and go skiing. So we're going to tell you a little bit about Beaver Creek. Beaver Creek is an unincorporated community. It's located in Eagle County, Colorado. And what that means is, unincorporated means that you don't really have any local municipalities or jurisdictions. So the closest town to it, which is kind of more of like a all year round community, is Avon. And in Colorado, you definitely have a contingency of seasonal people who go in to work at the ski mountains or in the summer. And then those generally are like the resort communities with these ski corporations and Ski Corp and other companies kind of own these facilities. And the one thing that's kind of interesting about Colorado is that the majority of these operations are actually on federal land. So when you're in Colorado and you're on a ski resort at the bottom of the mountain, you're in Colorado. And as soon as you get up into the ski area on the lift, you're in federal land. So you're actually under federal jurisdiction from the national forest system. And Beaver Creek operates under a land lease under the National Forest System to do, you know, permits from the White River National Forest from a certain date to a certain date. They can operate. It's a 30-year permit currently, and it's a bundle of rights to use the land without, they don't actually own the land, but basically, you know, they pay some sort of fee. I think it's like $1 a skier through the year, and this money goes into maintaining the wildlife and preserving the land. So Beaver Creek was settled in about 1865. It was like a pseudo mountain community for mining, but originally that the area was built around 1976 because it was going to be during for the Winter Olympics that year. They were planning to have this Beaver Creek development as part of the the Olympics, the Olympic Village. But needless to say, the state of Colorado, the voters turned it down, so it was partially built. And then the Beaver Creek ski area, as it's now known, it opened up in 1980, and it's a stone's throw from Vail, and they're actually considered kind of like one and the same. The Beaver Creek Vale is this the little valley that they are. They're about half hour apart, and they're owned by the same company. So we arrived. We were there for I think maybe 4 or 5 days, skiing 5 days in a row is a little bit tough. But I bought one of those season passes. You can get if you get them like a year before, they're the equivalent of going skiing like twice. I mean, if you get a day pass, it's like $200, but if you get a season pass, it's like $500-$600 if you get it the year before. So if you know you're making a trip, do it. Buy it now for next year. You will be happy about that. So in terms of our picking out of a real estate for the area, I was able to go see 31 Avondale Lane, which is called Oxford Court. Oxford Court condominium. It was really nice. I mean, I was actually, you know, I am used to New York City prices, but these are just straight up on the same level here, you know, in 1600 square foot, 3-bed, 2-bath condo. It's ski in, ski out. We'll run you around 1.2 to 1.6. So, I mean, this is just some vacation spot for some people, probably like a lot of local Denver people who come out. But I was a little shocked when I saw it. I mean, it's very nice. You know, each unit had a balcony, a fireplace, a big open kitchen with kind of like an island. They're kind of all in the similar style, but the building itself, you know, it had a hot tub, a pool, indoor, outdoor, full-time, super partial doorman. You could get some storage space, parking spot, and it was built around 1993, so it's new, but it's not, you know, it's kind of, if you go to Colorado, a lot of things were built in the 90s, and you can kind of get that feel there. But I was happy. A washer dryer in the unit. Ooh, it was nice. But you can, if you go there, there's a lot of local real estate agencies who work with these properties, such as Sotheby's or some of these local agencies right on the mountain, and they kind of specialize in maintaining these units, selling these units, and then, you know, obviously a lot of people only use it a couple weeks out of the year, and then you Airbnb them out or use them through a rental service. But I was very happy with it. I mean, check out some photos online. It was Oxford Court Condo in Beaver Creek, Colorado. Now, we're going to jump back to our home market of New York City. We have a February 2017 Manhattan monthly market snapshot. Overall, market-wide contract activity increased this past February, up 7% compared to this time last year. One note, the condo market saw a year-over-year increasing in all pricing metrics as the co-op market saw small decreases across the same metrics. Both markets, however, were marked by increases in the amount of time listings spent on the market. This is fueled by market-wide inventory growth, and also I do think that's partially sellers might be chasing a market or a past market, or they might be testing the waters out with high prices, and then as a result, buyers have more negotiability, and that is what we saw. Both markets have seen a negotiability of between the ask price and the actual closing price. In terms of the numbers for condominiums in Manhattan, the average sale price was $2.872 million, median sales price $1.75, average price per square foot $2,053. Average days on market, our most notable change is 173, so it's sitting around a little bit. Number of contracts signed, 425. If you have any questions about your Manhattan home, just feel free to send us a message on social media or call or text. I mean, it's 2017. You'll find a way to get us there. Co-op sales showed an uptick this past month, rising 17% from last February and a significant 35% from the previous month. This is in Manhattan. The average price held steady, although the average price per square foot dropped by 5%. The greatest decrease this month was seen in the market for three bedrooms, while the greatest increase was in the studio market. You're targeting first-time buyers. The interest rates are really attractive. And in New York right now, the cost to rent versus the cost to buy is attracting people right now. And also, it's first-time buyers. And with potential talk of interest rate hikes, maybe people want to get into the market who might have been sitting on the sidelines before. The median price also dipped year over year by 3%. As the condo market, average days on market for both co-ops increased as inventory grew. Both metrics were up by 5%. There was less negotiability this month than in January, specifically for co-ops. But for year over year, there was a little bit of negotiability for buyers this month. All right, let's jump to Brooklyn right now. February saw a double-digit increase in contract activity versus this time last year. 26% more sales. What are you, crazy? No, I'm not. That's what our report's telling us here. Listed inventory increased mostly up just 3% versus last February. The median and average price experienced significant annual gains with double-digit growth of 22% and 29% respectively. Ooh, tongue twister there with the nines and the twos. This marks the largest increase in pricing since March 2015, which was a hot time. But just to all you know, tell your brokers right now, don't be showing me comps from March 2015. It is March 2017. Let's get it straight. You know who you are out in Ridgewood. All bedroom types except for studios experienced a 6% rise in pricing over the last year, fueling overall price per square foot up 10% year over year to $880 per square foot. Everybody, I told you, you know, you got it. Last year was the year, but this year is still the year. I still see growth in our market right now. Overall in the city, I mean, it's kind of funny to think about, a generation ago, the suburbia was where young families and people wanted to be, and even just elderly people retiring. Statistics show that elderly people are retiring the city, young people are retiring the city, and people are choosing to raise their family. Young families are choosing to stay in smaller spaces to be around the activity, you know, around the people, around your friends. The trend of price discounts continued into February with an average price discount of 2.5% off the ask, and nearly half of all sales are below asking price. So that it's interesting. I mean, I do think that we saw a huge boost in Brooklyn home sales over the last 2 to 3 years, but this is kind of telling us that yes, although we're having historical all-time high prices, we are seeing a little bit of chasing here. So there's been talks about a move into a buyer's market. I think that's just going to depend in which submarket you're in, the type of housing, co-op, townhouse, condo, multifamily. That's gonna, you're gonna have to get more in depth with that. That's why you talk to your local broker or agent, and talk to me, message us if you're in a specific area, either in the city, New Jersey, tri-state, where you might want to feel more comfortable with a local person. We'll set you up, and we have all professional. You can talk to me or us in the city, and we have mortgage lenders, attorneys, painters, property management people, everybody to help you out. Look at my website for a more in-depth full report from us. You can click it. It goes back about 2 or 3 years, but we'll have the most recent February 2017 reports up there. Oh, and before we start our interview, hello. And before we start our interview, you know, we got to say hello to a few people and a happy birthday. First off, to me, happy birthday to me, March 23rd, 32 years young, feeling great. We have Sandra Lynn on March 22nd, Ban Lao today, 328, happy birthday. Mr. Adam Bowen, a longtime friend on another continent, 324, happy birthday. Miss Emily Weiss, a Skidmore grad, happy birthday to you, 328. PJ Stack, this Sunday, 327, happy birthday. Sean O'Neill, the 25th of March, and Matt Toth, March 20th. Happy birthday to everybody and best wishes to you. Now on to our interview with Trevor Mengel. We talk Japan, ad tech, the whole gamut. So this is a long form interview. If you like it, great. If not, not that concerned. Just kidding. Have a nice day. Test, test. All right, we are here. We have our guest today. His name is Trevor Mengel, a good friend of mine.
All right.
He's a Renaissance man. He motorcycled over here. He's an adventurer. He is an internet guy. And we also we went to school together.
You make me sound a lot cooler than I actually am.
I
try really hard, so appreciate the endorsement. Glad it's working.
But
it's
you're not. I mean, if you're cool, I mean, usually the definition of cool is like being awesome without trying. But
yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's the opposite of cool.
But you know, that's like anything. You got to work. You can't just. Michael Jordan didn't become Michael Jordan. You know, you can't just.
No.
Right away.
He shot out there, did free throws every night.
Yeah.
Until his fingers bled.
He probably cried a lot.
You know, everyone cries a lot in New York.
Or in private or online.
Sometimes.
So, we are here, and it's the end of the summer 2016. Trevor was so nice to come on my show here.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, and today we have a couple topics we're going to talk about. Trevor, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, what you do with yourself. And, you know, personal, private, everything.
Sure.
What your passions are.
Just lay it all out there. So I grew up in Western Massachusetts, farm town, South Hadley, Mass. Went to Skidmore College with Marcus. Learned a lot about the world there. And met some really good people. Tried starting a company that was sort of like a Foursquare, but for live events. Almost like PlanCast or Facebook Events is now. That ate it. About 2 months after I graduated, which meant it was time to find a real job, ended up reaching out to everyone who'd graduated from Skidmore, you know, in the past maybe 10 years, who was in advertising. I had drinks with a bunch of them and met up with our mutual friend, Alex Horowitz.
Yep.
And he later introduced me to John Mansell that night, who... Mm-hmm. You know, kicked off the career in ad tech, and I've been there for the past 6 years about. More recently, I was in Tokyo with a company called Critio, and came back and now I'm at Horizon Media, which is the largest independent ad agency in the world.
Also with my sister, coincidentally, also works there.
We work very closely. She's great.
She's great. She's wonderful.
Love Jill.
Jill, if you're listening. But so to go back, you mentioned a few things. You spent a year in Tokyo. In Japan. A lot of people who go to Japan love Japan, and they become, I guess you call it, Japanophiles.
Mm-hmm. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, but why does everyone get so interested in Japan when they go there?
It's a magical place. That's a really good question. I think it's going to be either hit or miss, but the fact that their culture was so isolated for so long and that they only opened up, you know, really after the Americans forced them to and the British forced them to, at the beginning of the Meiji Restoration, did they actually become like exposed to the rest of the world? So you have this culture that for thousands of years was you know, for the most part, isolated. So it's developed, you know, very uniquely from the rest of the world, or the rest of the region. And they have a lot of interesting culture that I think is beautiful, and a lot of people are intrigued by.
Well, the one thing is that they have a lot of attention to detail. Everything's meticulously done, and I always think, you know, doing something well is much better than doing many things okay. But a couple things, I mean, we're not going to talk about Japan forever, but a couple things. One of my friends works at Japanese company.
In the U.S. or in Japan?
In New York. He's one of the few non-Japanese there. He was saying that sometimes it can be lonely because you're kind of always considered an outsider.
A Gaijin. Gaijin-san.
Sorry, Gaijin?
Gaijin.
Gaijin.
Yep.
Kaijin.
So there's actually an official like word or salutation for outsider, and when you enter, I mean, not all, but many establishments, they will greet you formally as Gaijin-san, which is like Mr. Outsider, is the literal translation. So that still exists, and I can totally empathize with that.
The when I was traveling a lot, one of my next door neighbors was Japanese, and I really tried to befriend him, but he was just saying that every time he was very concerned because his friends didn't feel like they'd be so comfortable. Maybe it was the language barrier, but he was basically just like, you don't understand. He's just like, it's a Japanese thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There are many things that I think are just Japanese things. Well, you know, hentai is one of them.
What's hentai?
Hentai is anime pornography. That is something you don't find anywhere else.
I mean, I love cartoons, so I'd understand why you like cartoons, but in terms of like, you know, visual pleasure, I would think the real life is better.
In more than just a visual way, yes. But I think that you know, at times the culture there, especially with entertainment, is so very overstimulating. So you have like very flashy, like giant billboards, flashing lights everywhere. It's and generally the cuts, if you look at how pieces of content are created, they cut between pictures or between frames super, super quickly. And that's something that is definitely a big cultural difference, even though we've incorporated some of that into like American, you know, cinematography and commercials.
Why do you think they do that?
Because
it's been known to give people seizures,
question.
Right?
I mean, it can, and it's not just, you know, that was like Japanese a animation that, yeah, that does it. But it may be just because an evolution of how art evolved there. I think that they had things similar to like comic books ever before they were introduced to the West. So it is very much, even when you're watching a movie, it's shot very much, I think, in a very comic booky sort of way. So, you know, zooming in or quickly, you know, cutting into like someone's face as a reaction as they're saying something, and then back. It's I don't know. It's interesting, but also, you know, overwhelming if you're not used to it.
It's funny because overall they're kind of known as like a conservative society, but then their art, they're a very artistic society as well. You know, with tattoo. Well, you have some Japanese tattoos. You have the cartoons.
Yeah, I think the tattoos are sort of separate because in Japanese culture, tattooing is forbidden. So it's you know, it's only the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia, who has tattoos. I mean, there's some young Japanese who are sort of defying the norms and going outside of that, and they're mostly from our generation. But you walk into any place with you know, some old school folks with a tattoo, and you're probably going to be judged a little bit.
Well, I also heard, aren't the Yakuza actually originally Korean, or wasn't the original Yakuza, weren't they like landless Koreans who came to Japan and they had to go resort to the underworld?
It has been said. What I have read was,
it's the internet. I'm not really. We don't fact check in this show, so
yeah. So what I've read, I mean, there's like there's the actual history, the, you know, mythology, and then the propaganda. I think that, at least what I've read on Wikipedia and from talking to people, is that a lot of the Yakuza started on
an
island.
Where all facts are based.
At least all my facts. Nothing's real unless it's on Wikipedia. I think they started on the island of Kyushu, which is in, you know, sort of the southern quadrant of Japan, and it's a pretty large island, almost as large as Hokkaido, I think. And you know, when the, I guess, imperial government, you know, modernized their military and started taking control back from the shogunate, and you know, I guess removing the different armed elements of imperial shogunate Japan, they, you know, disbanded these large groups of warriors. And, you know, some joined the emperor and others rebelled. And you see movies like The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise, and that is actually, like, true story. I mean, true story, like, there wasn't literally a white guy,
yeah,
like, fighting with the Japanese, but this was a period in history in which you had samurai fighting against a modern military, like, the equivalent of a Spanish-American War military or, like, just pre-World War I. So pretty sophisticated, like, much more so than guys using, you know, swords and stuff like that. So they came from Kyushu. and I guess they were disbanded, and you know, many of them sort of, you know, lived as outsiders, not literally Gaijin, but you know, lived as sort of rebels.
I see.
And had to come up with a way to, you know, make money and live successfully independently of society.
Excellent.
So they formed, at least that's the myth.
Well, it's good, you know, going to school, I was an anthropology major, you know, I work in real estate, so I love people, where they live. So in the show, I always like to try to incorporate a little bit of travel, travel stories, history, things like that. But one thing I really wanted to talk about is, you know, you're in the online ad industry, and I'm a very concerned about internet privacy these days.
You and many people are.
I know. And this is one reason why I wanted to get you in, is because I feel like you know about these things. And if it'll, I mean, just so people should know, because I mean, just the other day, I used to be very tech savvy, like 2000.
Used to be
2007, 2009. And then I kind of like took a hiatus. Of like, I'm like, you know what, YouTube, the internet, whatever. And now I'm kind of, you know, I'm really interested. But a former company you work with, my company uses them for ad targeting. I get target specific ads all the time. But before we get into any of that, I got to ask one thing.
Absolutely. Shoot.
This Twitter photo, is this staged?
Yes. It is staged.
I trust you in that photo that you're looking to the future. You're going to manage a board.
Have you seen? Do you know? Go to critio.com.
Okay.
I think it's / about us. And this is, I think this will, it will make a lot more sense.
No, it's not there.
I think if you like put a dash between about and us.
Oh, yes, yes.
That may do the trick.
Okay, we got it. Okay, yep.
Mm-hmm.
What? you're the poster boy, man.
Yeah, so that's where that shot came from.
Oh.
Yeah, the Critio About Us page.
So you also have a side modeling career.
You know, occasionally, but just the hands.
Just the hands?
Just the hands.
I don't know. That's you're convincing. And I like the array of people they have. They have, you know, a white guy, white girl,
yeah.
Japanese dude. Some guy.
American guy, yeah. So it's
American guy with a beard. He doesn't look like he cares about showing up to work.
Well, he does.
He does.
So
he doesn't care about his haircut.
Great. It was a great guy. He'd been living in Japan for the past 8 years. Went there after high school, just learned the language, and was absolutely crushing it at like IBM Japan.
Good for him.
Learning to integrate with the Kaishan, like the salary man. And okay. Came up to me in an ad tech conference, Ad Tech Tokyo.
Come here.
He's like, hey, I'm super interested in what you guys are doing. Here's what I do right now. And he was like a trained engineer who was just interested in ad tech. And I think he'd done like a bunch of work on currency exchanges for IBM to some capacity. They build technology that supports currency exchanges. So, which is very similar to the type of advertising that I work in. So, hired him and he was great and is still with the company in Tokyo, crushing it.
So pretty much, I judged a book by its cover and I was dead wrong.
Okay. I mean, yeah.
We're just a little bit. we're gonna go back here. So technically, you're what you would call. What would you call yourself if you had to give yourself like a phrase or a title?
A title?
It doesn't have to be your professional title. It can be like a personal title, like your personal mission statement.
Personal mission statement. If I could take out my resume, I might just be able to come up with a good answer for that. But when people ask, and I'm trying to sound fancy, like at cocktail parties, I say that I'm a solutions architect.
I like that.
So
I like that.
Yeah.
Solutions.
Advertising technology solutions architect. That sounds nice.
Yeah.
I just read The Fountainhead, and I really always want to be an architect secretly, so now I am.
A recent book.
Not so recent. It's Ayn Rand. I'm probably saying Ayn. Rand. Yeah.
What's the big conservative book that Ayn Rand that everybody's
every single piece of literature that she wrote.
Okay. Yeah. I've actually never read any Ayn Rand's book. But I know last time I was over your house you're into self help books or like business books or organized. Listen, I'm reading 24 Laws of Power right now.
It's true.
I have the Dale Carnegie book. I read it once a year.
It's true.
I think it's someone was making fun of me today. I'm gonna let them remain nameless. my friend's girlfriend about self-help books. And I think, you know,
self-help books help. Like, there's some things that, like, people just don't tell you that are life lessons that you should know and that you can know to be better.
And this is what, and also this is one of my main inspirations for doing this podcast, because I'm now in my early 30s. One of those, like, hey, I wish anybody just told me a couple, like, very key, simple things, like some keystone habits or some keystone things that will affect everything else. And because it's a confusing world out there.
Yeah. So that's why we read The Power of Habit and Rich Dad Poor Dad and Becoming a Supple Leopard.
Supple leopard. What is a supple leopard?
A supple leopard is a very, supple, flexible, but strong, ready to pounce. One of the funnier titled self-help books that I own.
That's a sexy name.
It sounds nice, right?
It does.
Yeah, it's like the cover is sort of purple and white. It's a weird looking book, but it's actually a textbook on physically rehabbing yourself, and you know how to avoid pain and how to walk and sit with posture and most importantly like exercise with proper form so you don't get injured. And a lot of that has to do. The supple leopard analogy comes from, you know, in the animal kingdom, animals are always sort of like not necessarily on edge, but have a certain tension to them where they're ready to react at all moments. And humans, unlike that, although we're animals, you know, we sit on couches and watch TV for hours at a time without blinking.
So
not that I do that, but I know hours
without. Well, I mean, listen, I'm I work in real estate. One of the main I used to actually work in tech. I was kind of like a PHP programmer intermediary, like the business side between the PHP programmers for content delivery.
Yeah.
And after, I remember one of the seven times I was about to quit, I was looking at my watch and I was like, communicate via IM a lot. And I just realized I didn't talk to anybody for like 8 hours, just straight, nobody.
Where has this time gone?
I don't know. Right. And then I just said, I was like, you know, I can't do this. And I can't be behind a desk. It's so nice outside. So in real estate, I've broken free. I mean, I do 2 to 3 hours in the computer and I can't. Otherwise than that, my brain's not operating at full, production capacity. I can't. If you're doing one thing too much, then it's diminishing returns.
You need to get away, definitely.
So how do you work at your desk?
So I stand. I have a standing desk.
I heard you have a standing desk.
It's nice.
It's definitely better.
I'm lucky enough to have a good view in the corner of the office overlooking the Hudson River, which also helps. And I walk around a lot.
Inspirational scenery.
Some could say, yes. I mean, inspirational scenery is definitely it could be a factor. I don't know. It looks nice.
Well, you're also a camper.
Yeah,
you recently went on a camper in progress. Didn't you recently go on a little outdoor problem solving type thing?
It was a 7-day wilderness survival school.
Nice. I think that should be taught in schools.
It should be. The problem is people would die.
No, they won't. But
they would. You should have seen the liability waiver I had to sign for this program. It is literally like anything could happen. Before we went out on
the
course.
Of course anything could happen. You walk around New York City and you get hit by a car, anything could happen.
I mean, but they're not like, we went out, they take, you know, they take pictures, they have all of our information, height, whatever. We had to take shoe prints. And like size of the shoe, like the brand. So if you get lost, because we were out there, we trekked over maybe 60, 70 miles. Felt like way, way more because the terrain
was not even.
A lot of miles. And people have gotten lost. People have gotten lost for a reasonable period of time. Most survival situations last 72 hours. I think, you know, people are either found
until you bite the bullet. Until you bite the bullet.
Until I mean, depends. If you know what to do, you don't. I mean, by bite the bullet, do you mean just die?
Oh, that didn't really make any sense, right?
I mean, because you could bite the bullet and be like, all right, I'm gonna tough this out. And
yeah, I guess that wasn't a very good turn of phrase there.
Well, it could be, or like, you know, take the bullet. Yeah.
Well, I'm people who know me. I'm very passionate about survival. I think it's a core skill that everybody should learn. It's like in school they gotta tell you how to like do your taxes. Teach you
they
about
should. Did te- they in your school?
No.
No.
No, obviously exactly. not. Teach you about the fact that you are a teenager and just be like, you have tons of raging hormones going through your body right now. Just relax. Mm. And then survival skills, because I feel if our I didn't realize this because I grew up camping. I was a Boy Scout. My dad was an Eagle Scout.
Nice.
One of my personal life goals is to sleep outside 365 days before I die. So I'm at like 125.
Oh, 365 days total.
Total, like consecutive, it's going to be hard.
I thought you were looking for that day that was 365 days before you die.
Oh.
And that would have been really hard to calculate.
Unless you're planning it.
Let's not get that dark right
dark,
now.
Very yeah. dark.
So what? how many have you clocked in on?
I believe I haven't written down, but I believe I'm in like the 122 to 125.
You've got me beat by far. I think I have like outside, like no tent.
Tents count.
Okay.
Tents count. Also, tents count. I think that if you're like, you know, you tents count, hammocks count, I guess. Some other things count.
Yeah, if you have a tent or a hammock, that is definitely a luxurious experience. I think I have 7 days clocked with no tent. Not 8 days, actually. There's one time camping, and then maybe another six with tents. So you have me beat by a good margin.
The key is that you have to get them done in bulk. You have to do like a couple 5 days, couple 3 days.
Yeah.
We had our a guest who sometimes comes on. Mr. Dan Driscoll was here for a second. We'll see. Maybe if he'll join us in a little bit. We'll see.
Nice.
But yes, I also just think that if it was taught in schools to kids, children, everybody at a young age, and it became part of the culture, that it, because it used to be like right in the 50s and the 60s, it used to be. Now, because we're in this technological age, people don't think about it as much. I think it would give you martial arts, it would give you like a personal sense of security. Being
it
like,
does. It does.
You know?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when people talk about the convergence of like humans with technology, like the point at which we don't know how to survive as humans without technology is the point in which that convergence happens. And I think we may, like within this generation, we may already be there.
The singularity.
Mean. Yeah, yeah. Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah.
Are we there?
Are we? Are we already there and we don't even know it?
I could be.
Well, one thing I think is kind of interesting is that, you know, with social media online, you're actually we've officially have a reference point for the collective unconsciousness. And we moved from being a self-contained, like we moved from being everything. And now we store different memories on the cloud. Our brain function is actually upgraded to the machines, and we're actually, I'm sure, I mean, we should probably look up some science facts about this, but I'm sure that different parts of your brain are evolving in different ways. Like, imagine this. Like, one thing I think I'm very happy about, and you and I are I'm very happy about, is that, I mean, I don't know if you're happy about this, but we grew up in the age of the internet where we were of age. We were early enough and young enough. We were early enough where we could adapt the skills and be very proficient at it, but we knew we weren't quite adults, but we were in process of becoming adults before the full blown internet.
What were your top frequented sites when you were you know, going through that phase in your life?
I mean, I can't remember all the facts and the details, but I think
there was AltaVista.
Oh, I thought you were thinking about something else.
No, and then there was every other site.
Oh, AltaVista, of course. Yeah, yes, AltaVista. Yeah. Ask Jeeves was one of them.
Ask Jeeves
was
one of them.
AltaVista was one.
What were the other ones?
Listen, I thought you were talking about pornography.
Why would you think that, Marcus?
Because it's the most visited. It is also with VR, it's going to push. It pushes all the technology because it's like it drives the traffic. You can deal with the volume and the compression of videos.
Yeah, they're driving. I mean, video especially. I mean, images. And you look at even the decision between like Blu-ray or HD DVD. Remember that?
It was the
porn industry that decided that Blu-ray was going to be the superior technology. And they've driven a lot in terms of the internet. It's hard. It's funny because you can't really talk about it. It's a faux pas subject within.
But it runs,
you know,
everything.
American conversation.
Yeah.
It runs a lot, and you know, the distribution of people who are watching, you know, explicit content, it's not limited to, you know, major metropolitan, like, liberal areas.
Of course.
It's ubiquitous, nearly.
And it's got enough money that it can make the technology move forward.
It has, and it does.
So on that note, with, you know, one, I in my mind, I always kind of conceptualized about how you track people on the internet, and I always just like, oh yeah, you can obviously track people on the internet. And then I actually went to some of my own sites that I have, and I didn't realize how much information you can find out from just someone's ISP, like where they are on the block they are.
Yeah, yeah. So there,
that's like, I mean, easy information to get on any website.
Down to the block. So you're looking at the ISP of a website that you're coming from, or
that's from coming to my website as an administrator.
Yeah. Yep. Wait. So you can look at the ISP. Wow. Does Google Analytics do that, or what program gives you that information?
My own personal website.
Okay, so your own personal ISP.
Yeah, my own personal website. Yeah.
Yeah, and that goes out to the, you know, like when your browser puts a request, so makes a call to another ad server. Oftentimes, it will contain that ISP. I mean, it's all going through that little box that, you know, your Wi-Fi is attached to.
So when I connect to, say, Amazon, let's use a different one because that's a different website. Let's say I connect to Joe's Barbershop website, right? Mm-hmm. When I go there,
am I making an appointment? What are you doing?
I'm looking to see what their hours are to be open, right? So yep. I'm looking to see if I can get a haircut tomorrow. When I connect to that website, am I connecting to Joe's server that he's on, or do I go through you guys first? Do I go through ad networks first before I get to his website to land there?
Yeah, I mean, not just ad networks and not just, you know, advertising companies. You go through, actually, there's a browser plugin called Ghostery that I would recommend all the listeners to download, that will tell you which companies are tracking you as your browser.
Ghostery, like a factory of ghosts.
Like a factory of ghosts.
Yep. Oh, I love that name. That's a great name.
It's a great name, and it's a pretty cool company because you install this plugin and it's free, but it will tell you as a page is loading, as a link is loading, which companies are, you know, dropping cookies or able to track you based upon your activity. So you can really see who the different players are in the, you know, data, and, like, you know, behavioral. What we call as advertisers, like a behavioral audience creation space. So these are data providers who, you know, collect people's browsing activity through, you know, having sort of a connection, but almost like a people into what people are doing it within their browsers. And that's not to scare them. This is all like an anonymous technology. It's almost like users leave footprints across the different pages that they browse online, and, you know, the companies who, I guess, whose property those footprints are on are able to, you know, see those footprints or see that a user has been on their property in the future.
So I have a couple questions here.
Yeah.
Tell everybody, what is a cookie?
What is a cookie is a piece of script that many websites will end up dropping on a user's browser. So dropping just means they're writing a piece of script on a user's browser.
So that means I open up Chrome, I go to newyorktimes.com.
Yes.
And we have a little guest here. He's a little French bulldog. So if you hear him,
is he snorting or crying?
He's snarling. He's just smelling. That's not Trevor.
He sounds. No, I don't make those sounds. At least when I'm talking.
So. When you go, so I go to newyorktimes.com. Mm-hmm. Who's dropping the cookie on me? Is the internet website dropping on me? Is the browser dropping it on me? And how does that? If you were to visualize it,
many different players. So if you look at, you know what, there's a technology called an iframe, and you know, most ads are built within iframes. And when you think of what an iframe is on a web page, it's a website within a website. So when you're looking at a page, like, you see a two-dimensional, like, screen, you know, that looks, you know, like a newspaper, but things are moving around, it's a little bit more interesting. But since the web is dynamic, web pages and browsers have the ability to display multiple multiple web pages within a specific window. So even though you're looking at a web page, like there may be, you know, many different pages behind the page that is actually within your view.
Just because this is an audio format to give someone a visualization. So you have your rectangle of your desktop. Yeah. It's fully exposed. There's one page there. When you say that there's a website within a website, are certain pixels on the page sold to someone else who has direct access to it? Is there layers top of layers, or are they divided into, like, if you go in New York, is like, is the this block, if you're visualizing in your head, is this block between A and B and versus 14th and 15th Street?
Yeah, it's so I'm going to be as technical as I can. I'm not an engineer, but this will be a half-assed attempt at explaining how this works.
Lovely.
But it's almost like when you're looking at a web page, it's like the facade of a house. And that facade, like, you have the siding, and that's where most of your content is. If you're on the New York Times, that's the editorial piece that you're reading.
So, for instance, the Native American tribe puts up a fight against somebody.
They have a fight. They're staging a sit-in on the.
So the actual creative, creative content.
So the creative. Well, you have the editorial content, okay. Or you have a video. I think when you're talking about creative content, that's typically, you know, like the creative, like the Don Draper, the big idea.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at a web page, so advertisements may appear as like windows on that web page, right? So if you're looking at a page, you may have, you know, 1 to 4 different advertisements, display banners within that page. Each of those display banners, each of those windows represents what's essentially a different website. So that website has the ability to also drop what's called a cookie. Yeah, what we discuss is cookies on your browser. Through a technology that's called a pixel.
Oh, yes. And so what is a pixel?
What is a pixel? So a pixel is a one by one. We all know, like, the pixel dimensions of a TV.
Or a GIF.
Of a monitor or of a GIF or a GIF or whatever you want to call it. but a pixel is a one by one, you know, transparent object within that's actually on, you know, on your screen or within a web page. That essentially makes a call to a third party. So makes a call to another ad server that is not first party.
So if you're going to New York Times, that is not the New York Times. Like, for instance, we're just pulling this up right now, but just we're looking at the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah. So if you keep scrolling down, you'll see ads. I used the same example when describing what we did to interns earlier.
To the right. Yeah. So what is perfect. That? Perfect. A real estate advertisement. It's cool. Style meets convenience. Some place in Florida. Michael Saunders.
Is there? So you see on the upper right hand side of that ad, how they have what's a little ad choices icon? Is that there?
No.
So if it's not there, that means it might be hard coded into the site. But I don't really believe that. So all ads, when you see them within a web page, are supposed to have this little. You know, triangle.
Right here. I see it right here in the skin security
exactly.
ad.
So let's,
ad choices.
Let's open that. So ad choices sort of identifies who in, you know, the advertising space was serving you that ad. This, no surprise, it's Google Ads. So the New York Times, one could say, partners with Google to have Google, deliver them with demand. So deliver them advertisements that are going to be shown on their page.
Ah, okay.
And they also help the New York Times track users that advertisers want to buy.
Okay.
Google is one of the largest players in the space, as is, you know, Facebook, Yahoo, Microsoft.
Oh, okay.
The big guys.
The big guys.
The four horsemen. So the apocalypse. Used to be.
All right. So we have a lipstick ad here, and so essentially. This the New York Times sells this little space, and then Google fills that space, and then Google sends that traffic to.
We'll fill, yeah. That you can imagine that, you know, before, as this web page is loading, the browser and the page itself will say, we have this spot that can fit a 300x250 ad. Like, that's the format you're looking at.
Okay.
And what will happen? So as your page is loading, Google, who has what's called a tag within that iframe. A tag is, you know, like a line, a connection to a third-party server. we'll send out a call to what's called a publisher ad server, which will then in turn send another call out to, at least if it's a programmatic impression, out to an SSP, supply side platform. So here's where we get all like financy on this.
In the supply side platform, is that serving the content of the image of the ad through the network?
So the advertiser ad server, so that's at the other end of the spectrum. You have this one server that's just looking to see which ads should, or what, you know, what creative should fill this miniature window on a web page. So it's another website. So any image can go there. There's a publisher ad server that is responsible just for figuring out which ad will go there or who has the right to be able to serve an ad there.
Okay. Okay. And that's based on their pre-existing whatever.
That's based off of business rules, and also like talking about, there's a whole exchange, dynamic that occurs that's very similar to like the NASDAQ or the NYSE that happens where advertisers are, you know, bidding against each other from a demand side platform, a DSP, to compete for the opportunity to serve you an impression, to serve you an ad.
My big question about this whole thing is My big question about this whole thing is that how do you create the monetary value of it? Because in the day and the age of the internet, isn't it going to be like a black hole for like web traffic?
A black hole. So how do we know the value of who we want to serve an ad?
So for instance, if I'm product X, Y, and Z, mm-hmm. and I'm selling ads or whatever, what happens if someone just gets a bot?
Oh, well bots, I mean, bots happen. They're part of the internet. If you look at, I mean, like, Google search, like in their technology that crawls web pages, like those could be considered bots. Like what's considered, you know, bot traffic is not dissimilar from the crawlers that Google uses to like index their search engine.
Crawler,
creepy crawler, spider.
A creepy crawler.
They call them too, yeah. But it's pretty much like a fake user that you know creates traffic to a web page and, you know, crawls or scans that web page for the content that's on it and then indexes that content into a database. And that's in a very simplified version of what Google is as a search company.
So I go to a website. I want to buy a pair of scissors.
What are you going to do with those scissors?
I'm going to cut my dog's hair. I'm an aspiring dog hair cutter.
So you're on what site are you on for this? Are you on Petco?
Petco. No, just doghaircutters.com.
Great site. Love it.
Have you ever heard of them? Every Supply. This show has been brought to you by doghaircutters.com. So I want to go.
We'll find that site later and wrestle some money out of it.
Yeah, I mean this featuring on this show is like to the moon. Doghaircutters.com. I order something, or I say I don't order. I just look and I
you
save
just
it.
Look
and I save it. I make an account. I save a cart. How much does doglovers.com know about me? What can they do?
Well, how much do they know about you? Like it depends what they're trying to do with it. So if they're trying to send you like a follow up email that says, "Hey Marcus, how about those dog scissors that you left in your shopping cart?" Like they have all of your registration data, which means they can use that on a first party basis to, you know, customize the messaging that they deliver to you on a one-to-one basis. So it's their, you know, CRM software.
That's information you willingly give to them. Yeah. Say, my name is Brian Smith, and I live at this address. This is my email.
Yep.
Okay.
So they may use your name to personalize images. Are they using your address to send you, some type of, direct mail? Perhaps, man. Like, if you get direct mail, chances are that it's like when people used to sign up for the Sears catalog, or you shop at Sears, or you do that mail order, they're going to like send you coupons for Sears. This was a lot of what happens in online advertising is very similar to, it's like a more sophisticated version of direct mail.
Okay. Next question.
Ready.
The next, so I gave my information. I have an account with that company. Mm-hmm. Like I was talking to you before, mm-hmm. the admin of that The admin of that website, now has my ISP, right?
They have.
I have no protections. Let's just say I have no ad protection, no nothing.
No ad protection. So, your ISP, do they see it? You know, it's not like if the carrier network would see your ISP because they're just, you know, directing traffic and routing it from one server to another, but are they collecting that information to use for marketing purposes? No, I think that they are. If you're visiting that site, they're able to drop a cookie on your browser.
Okay. Okay.
Yep. So, and if they enter in your name and your email, they now have your email address and they can hash that, which allows them to, you know, essentially transact or find you on other devices by trading a code that's associated with your email for, you know, someone else who has a code that's also associated with your email.
So who has the other code that's associated with my email?
So third party advertising technology companies. I mean, if you look at Experian, for instance, or Oracle, these are for the most part, you know, marketing technology companies, which, you know, they collect information and they're able to use that and then, you know, translate. You know, if A equals C, and we're trying to find out, does user C equal user A? But we know in the back, we know it does. Let's assume that the technology doesn't. A technology can arrive at that by like A equals B and B equals C, therefore A equals C. So that's how a lot of this technology works.
To match the next.
Exactly.
I see.
You have an independent third party that's called like in it's called a data safe haven, and this is mandated by law that you know is pretty much the like acts as a middleman intermediary that keeps individual data like PII, personally identifiable information, private, because it always has to pass through a third party that, you know, hashes it, pretty much jumbles it up and matches it with another, you know, company C.
Oh, so are you saying that when your information goes through, it's mandated to be anonymized?
If it's used for marketing purposes outside of sending, like, if it's used for like second or third party marketing purposes, then yes. I mean, I'm not a regulatory expert, but like a site can use your name to, when you log in, for instance, or if you're logged in on your browser, to, you know, create a message that says like, "Hi Marcus, welcome to Amazon," right? And it'll save your password. The same technology that enables marketers and other companies to track your activity online.
Okay. So when you a few times, just to clarify, you reference first, second, and third party. Who are all these? Who are these parties?
It depends who you are. Since I'm
where's the party at?
It depends which one you want to go to. But if you're a marketer or an advertiser, then your own data. So you say I'm you know, pet company,
pet hair scissors cutters.com.
cutters.com, and a user visits your website and you drop a cookie on them, and you know that they may register with you and you have their email address. Then that information, as an advertiser, that information is first party information. That's mine. I own it. I collected it, you know, and it was, I did that interaction.
So just to go back a little bit, do you have to automate, like, are you just allowed to drop cookies? Do you have to tell them you're dropping cookies, or you're?
Some, it depends where you are. You know, many sites are proactively messaging users and telling them that they can opt in, or that they need to press okay, or like at least acknowledge that they're aware that this company is dropping cookies. That's the case. I think that is actually regulated in Europe. So many American companies have adopted that. But it's not a mandate in the US yet. But I think it makes the user definitely more aware of what's going on.
Interesting. Okay. So
that's first party data.
That's first party data. And that's also, you in America, you do not need to be informed if a cookie is dropped on you.
It will say it somewhere. Like oftentimes it will be in the end user agreement of your browser.
No one reads that.
Or if you're signing up for a new newsletter or service, you know, it will often, you can opt out of your, you know, information potentially being shared by third parties for marketing purposes, and that happens all the time. But generally somewhere, which is, you know, will be on a site if you look for it. If you look at the footer of most pages, there will be a privacy policy on every web page, and that privacy policy will, you know, expose you to what's going on.
Okay, that makes sense. Party two.
So second-party data. As an advertiser, second-party data would be from a publisher. So if I'm pet dog, shears, scissors,
.com/maximumfun, yeah.
And I went to thenewyorktimes.com, and the New York Times has a pet section because dogs are all the rage in New York. If the New York Times were to collect information, so to tag or drop cookies on the different users who have read content from their dog section, and I, as, you know, petscissorsshearscompany.com, wanted to target those users for marketing purposes, I could purchase that data from the New York Times. And I'm not saying the New York Times can do this or that they have a section called dogs.com.
We are using the New York Times as a generic example that people in New York will go to that website. Let's clarify that. We've clarified that. Okay. We've said it.
It's there. It's on record.
Yeah.
Sorry, New York Times. And dogs, New York Times, or any other website could take this data and they could sell it to a marketer and say, if I'm trying to prospect, if I'm looking for new users, new customers to come to my site and buy the best dog scissors that are out there, where do I find them? It's not just people who, you know, hear about me through like word of mouth, but if I'm, you know, marketing my company online, then I want to find people who like dogs because those are my customers. Those are my future customers. And so I buy that data from any website, but in this case, the New York Times, and I use it to find those users on, you know, many web pages that they could be visiting.
Other web pages.
So it depends. So some publishers will restrict use of their data to their properties alone.
And when you say properties, what do you mean by that?
Properties, websites. Websites that are owned and operated. ONOs. But sometimes they also will sell that information, say, okay, you can use that. Or we can buy our data, our users across, you know, the entire internet. So you can find these users, whether they're on, you know, the Gmail. New York Times, or, I mean, Gmail doesn't really have, but Gmail is something different. So maybe not Gmail.
Okay, we'll avoid that.
Every
one
site that has, you know, standard banner advertising.
Huffington Post, the Gazette.
Yep.
Stuff like that.
Yep. Absolutely. Okay. Third party data.
Okay, yeah, third party data. Let's go to third party data.
So third party data is sort of secondhand. So if the New York Times or another site, they have a web page and they're tracking, you know, that they're dropping their own cookies on your browser to save your password, to, you know, connect it with your account. But they also allow third parties to drop pixels like we were talking about earlier onto a user's browser, and they do this through that iframe, so through the window. It's like throwing this
through that little space that other company leased to them.
Exactly. Yeah, not necessarily leased, but they're just there, so third parties can track you, you know, through the window on a web page, and you know, that looks
the
like
window meaning the advertisement.
The window meaning the advertisement. The advertisement is a window and also like a separate web page.
Yeah, and then what is also, just to clarify again, the difference between a pixel and a cookie, because they sound a little similar.
So a pixel is the mechanism by which a cookie is dropped.
Ah,
so it's that one by one. It's the one by one transparent. Yeah, literally a pixel, a transparent pixel on the web page. Whereas the cookie is a piece of script that's just a separate like numerical code. You can look at the cookies on your your browser. They're all like anonymized, just, you know, numbers and letters that don't make any damn sense.
Okay.
And they are pretty much like post-its that are appended to your browser until either you clear them or they naturally expire.
Okay. So they do have shelf lives.
They do have
some of them.
They do. It's mandated that they have shelf lives.
That's good. I think that's good.
It is.
Also, your trends change.
You know, you got to keep up with the times.
Now, yes, you do. What is the typical shelf life of a cookie?
I'd say 30 when to those cookies 60 get stale. Days. 30 to 60 days, but I mean, it depends. Do they get scale from a marketing perspective? You can say that if you were on a major travel site and, you know, you were about to purchase, you know, a plane tickets and a cruise for your family, like that's, you know, could be worth, you know, family of four, week long trip, you know, $5,500 maybe. But if, you know, so that's okay. So day one, you don't buy anything. Day two, maybe not. Day three, you find a better price elsewhere and you buy it. The thing is, that site that you're visiting on, you know, day zero, mm-hmm. that maybe you're doing your research on,
yeah,
like they're thinking that you're worth a ton of money to them because you're about to spend $5,500. So yeah. there's an art and a science behind determining when is the right time to let a cookie go, to let a user go, and to determine that a customer is no longer worth, you know, bidding on or buying, you know, to serve them an advertisement.
One thing when you were explaining the window within the window platforms, whatever, all the, everything we just talked about, it's weird how your mind tries to wrap around the visualization of the physical space world that you live in and the website world.
Yep.
Where like people are walking on, I feel like you're like walking on this website.
Yeah. You're browsing, you're skipping on through, and every new web page that you visit could have a new group of people, you know, not of people literally, but of different companies who are, you know, placing information on your browser.
Is it easy to, if you wanted to anonymize yourself, what are the benefits mm-hmm. of doing that, or not, or the disadvantages of doing that?
I mean, if we want to anonymize ourselves, we should go live in a desert in Utah. I think that it's, I mean, that's not completely radical, but like in this day and age, I think that, you know, the fear of, you know, a malicious person tracking you, like that's largely understood as a, you know, reality of doing business. I think that if you look at the Snowden sort of reveal and everything yeah. that exposed from the federal government, like that is only a, like this technology that we're using to market is not in any way as developed or complex or personalized as that, and we all have acknowledged that that's happening.
But because we know that the private sector has this technology already, mm-hmm. it kind of makes people, especially in the internet, it's like it makes your mind go, you're like, oh man, this is only the surface.
It does, and I guess that there are those who are of the opinion that like if you're embarrassed that if you'd be embarrassed for somebody else to see you doing something, or if you're doing something that you don't want other people to see online, then, you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
I do think in this day of the age of the internet, like you can't really hide anything. You have to be your authentic self all the time.
Authentic. That's part of it. Yeah.
But it's before 1995, it was like a choice. And now it's you have to do it to be like a regular human being, or just achieve and connect with people in a certain way where they'll trust you, and it
needs to resonate. And I think you need to definitely expose yourself in order for people to empathize with you. And I think a lot of, you know, like creators, influencers online, like gain their influence through exposing certain things that, you know, resonate with people in certain ways, and, you know, allow them to sort of enter that other, you know, that other person's life for a minute. Which is generally like a much cooler life than like either of us are living, right?
Like, I don't know. I feel like if you put your, that's the thing, is that there's a difference between being on Facebook and posting a lot and being a YouTube celebrity or something like that, where yeah. your whole life becomes kind of like a performance.
It's not like a business model, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to be able to do that. I personally think it would be tough to, 24/7 or to be a Kardashian or,
It's probably stressful, man.
You know, they deserve all the success that they get, because I think most people don't have the patience to allow cameras around them 24/7.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's no good. Well, so where do you think anything's going to be changing in the realm of online advertising and privacy? Do you think, so you were kind of saying that it's kind of a little bit blown out of proportion about privacy experts who are concerned about this kind of thing, but.
I mean, I was taking a pretty polarizing perspective on that, you know, towards the side of like openness and you know, lack of privacy. But I think that people to whom privacy is important should have the choice. I mean, you know, whether you want to see advertisements that are personalized or not, or whether you want to be automatically logged into your site, or you know, receive personalized emails from a marketer, I think that's someone's choice, and everyone, like, marketing should be and should take the form of what the best way to communicate with an individual user. And I think it's a failure of advertising. It's a waste of money when someone is delivering an advertisement that creeps someone out. Like, if you're creeped out by an ad, then somebody wasted money showing you that ad.
Yeah.
And it's just a bad, it's a poor job, and I'm not necessarily a bad job, but I think as an industry, we can do a better job of, you know, respecting people's privacy, but also detecting people's need for privacy. I think that that's all oftentimes.
It's a subtle line of like a nuance of what you appreciate and what you get not offended by, but.
And there is no opt into it now. So we see reactions on Facebook and in other places, but I mean, there's not like a dial for the volume of personalization in the advertisements that you receive. And so it's either it's binary. It's either you opt in, or if you opt out, then you're just going to receive generic advertisements. Or if you install, you know, an ad blocking software, you're not going to receive any for now.
Do you know, with kind of some things with like Airbnb and Uber and like ride sharing things, do you think that people should be like, if I'm on the online all the time, can I sell my data traffic?
Can you sell it? So I knew a guy who's actually,
is it worth enough to sell it?
I knew a guy who was creating a browser that would let you sell it.
Okay.
The thing is, if you're selling it, does that mean that someone else isn't getting it? Like, because right now, when you look at who is reaping, you know, the benefits of your data, it's those websites that, you know, whose journalism you consume without cost, right? So I think,
so if, for example, mean the 10 best places to go visit in upstate New York.
Yeah, well, if
the content maker.
I mean, so publishers make that they make revenue from two different ways, right? Either people are paying for subscriptions, or they're, you know, seeing advertisements, and then it's their attention that's sold.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, most people, if you look at distribution of most newspapers, it's gone down substantially in the past, you know, 20 since the internet came up, right? And that's why so many publishers are angry at Google. But the internet is, you know, fueled, like, journalists' salaries are paid by advertising. I think a lot of users forget that when they're it's, you know, very concerned with their privacy. But there is and there should be a more known exchange of value in when a user is reading a piece of content on a site. Like, you should know that, you know, this is brought to you by, okay, there's a sponsorship, there's a banner there. But I think the fact that the banner being there enables that editorial to be read is sort of, you know, that's not explicitly, brought to awareness by publishers.
I mean, in this realm too, it kind of brings into another thing too. It's kind of like almost capitalistic, but also it kind of involves sort of like classism and a little bit of possibly racism. I mean, listen, if you're a really wealthy person, you spend a lot of money, like, can you go on the marketplace and be like, hey, this is what my web traffic is worth. Maybe you could convince me to go buy your thing.
Maybe.
Do people,
so putting it up for a bit? I don't know anything today where you can do that.
Yeah.
The thing is, there are other, like, many web blockers will actually sell, you know, for a certain cost, they will allow select marketers to actually serve you advertisements. So that's sort of like a misnomer about ad blockers, is that they block 100% of your ads. They don't. Mm. They do, as other companies, you know, sell your information and enable ads to be sold and delivered in certain circumstances. But back to your point, if you're a wealthy person, yes, your data is worth much more.
Like, you have certain websites with certain types of readership that, you know, like,
exactly. You look at like Fortune Magazine, Bloomberg, you know, Business Insider to a certain extent, like you have like an educated, high income, you know, urban individuals with, you know, lots of discretionary income. And that's like, that's who everyone is looking for. Like, if I'm a BMW, if I'm a Lexus, if I'm a Hyundai Genesis, like that's the user who I want to get in front of. And we'll pay a lot to get in front of that user, especially in the right environment.
Especially, that's a good note, in the right environment.
At the right time.
At the right time.
With the right message.
Also, I mean, I always, I do, my profession's real estate, so I deal with it sometimes. Sometimes it's a lot, I feel a lot of it is about momentum in the moment and the timing. Like, timing is everything for a lot of people. And if you can do it with computers, great. A lot of times it's also like you need the interpretation of people to do it as well.
Yeah.
Can I go right now and find out? We'll wrap this up in a second. I was going to say this. Can I go? Last question. Can I go online right now and see what marketers think about me right now Like, what definitions of, like, why they gave me that ad? Do they, like, so classifications?
If you find an ad that's retargeting you, so if you go to, like, a Zappos.com, you look at a pair of shoes, and that pair of shoes follows you around in the little window, you know, on every website you go to, you can click on the ad choices icon, which will give you a lot more information. It's different, but it will bring you to the explanation that each company has for serving you that ad. So if you go to a retargeter, oftentimes they will show you, you know, the product that you clicked on or that you engaged with that led to their decision to, you know, serve you this advertisement. And then they'll also show you every other product that you looked at. So some companies are more transparent with their methodology than others, but if you're ever curious, click on the ad choices icon, which should be on the upper right hand side of every ad you look at.
I don't even want to know what they say about me.
Well, that's why incognito mode exists. Yeah, I hope you use it.
I should. I'll learn more though. But you can send me a few links about where to find these privacy things and a little bit more. But
absolutely.
I think that's it. I think we wrapped it up. We had a good, lovely conversation. Anything else you want
to
talk about?
It's a great time. I mean, I think we need to do this again soon.
Oh yeah, gotta teach the people something. So before we go out, if you want to find people to find you on the internet, what's your Twitter? Your Facebook? If you want, if you don't, that's okay too.
Twitter is at TrevorM88.
Great picture, by the way.
Thank you. Certainly not a selfie. And I think it's the same on Instagram. My Instagram is TrevorM88 as well.
Perfect.
Trevor Mengel on LinkedIn or Facebook if you want to look me up.
Awesome. So that was great. I'm so happy that you came. High five.
Cool.
Yeah. Great. I thought we learned something.
Great contact there.
All right. Great. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. If you want to follow, like, subscribe, thank you so much. Have a good day. Have a good evening. Goodbye. Woo.
That's the way the cookie crumbles.
Yeah. Oh, man. See that? Oh, well, that does it for today's podcast. It was such a great time. I had a wonderful time here today. I just want to thank you for tuning in. Thank you to my guest, Trevor. If you have any other questions, I'll include his social media in the show notes. If you enjoyed the podcast or you want to come on and talk with me, oh, I would love that. Just shoot me a message. We can talk real estate. We can talk dogs. We can talk whatever you want. And if you do enjoy what we're doing here, you know, always reach out to me. As you might know, if you're a friend of mine, or if you don't, or if you're new to the show, I'm a real estate agent. We do property management, we buy, sell, rent. So anything you want to talk about, just shoot me a line. That's great. And I'm so happy to say that we're at our 500 subscriber mark. That's great. Between our two shows, this one is about more about housing and a little more serious, and then we have a silly show, Send It to Space. More silly, I should say. But thank you for tuning in, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you. Have a good day.